Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Hi, everybody. I think I just made it on Facebook and on YouTube. I think we're all set. So welcome. Welcome to the Ron Brooks Show. We've got a bunch of topics to talk about today, so I'm excited about that. I hope you enjoyed some of the added decorations. We got some flowers. We've got a Brian Lawson painting up there. You can find more of his paintings at Quint Corder Gallery. You can find that online on just Google Quint Corder. We've got a reproduction of the Vine, one of my favorite sculptures. It's at the Met. The original is at the Met. You can see it there. We got a little plant there. You see my files. Yeah, we'll replace those with some books at some point. And right above my head, we're going to put some posters. I'm going to put a poster here. And we're going to put some posters over here. And we're going to liven up the room, so we're going to make it a lot prettier and a lot nicer. And I'm heading to California next week for OCON, and I'll be at my house in California. And when I'm there, I'll be doing shows from California. So we'll be doing some shows from there. But while I'm there, I will be picking up some posters. I have a ton of posters, some gorgeous, amazing stuff in California. I'm going to bring it here and going to start putting it up. And so we're gonna make this much nicer. I've also got a plan out to get a better camera, get a better picture quality, get a better camera. You know, we'll work on that when I get back to Puerto Rico in a few weeks. So things are moving slowly. We're getting there. So those of you on YouTube, we will get you a better experience. Somebody's asking if I'm coming to Australia. Not anytime soon. I don't have any plans to come to Australia. I think the international plans I have right now, for those of you interested, are Brazil in late August, early September. I'm going to do a number of cities, talks of cities in Brazil. So back to Brazil. This will be my second time this year, but there's a lot of demand there. And then we will go to September. We've got a conference for businessmen in London. If anybody's interested in attending, it's a $5,000 price tag. It's me and John Allison and Lars Christensen and Tal Tzfani, the new CEO of AOI, are the speakers. If you're interested, $5,000, then let me know. And we've got that going on in late September in London. I'll be there for that. I'll be in Switzerland, and I'll be at the Mont Pelerin Society meetings at the Canary Islands. That'll be fun. And then I'm off to, I'll do a Students for Liberty regional conference in Paris. Then probably in November, I'll do a probably Tbilisi, maybe Slovakia, and a bunch of other countries in Europe in between. And there's the potential I'm going to Asia, but nothing's determined yet. So that's just a quick plan of the fall. In addition to that, I'll be speaking in August. For those of you who live in Colorado or in the area, I'll be speaking in August at Steamboat Springs Institute in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. And I'll be speaking in California probably in October. And we've got a bunch of other talks lined up and in the works. So it's going to be an exciting second half of the year. But right now, I'm prepping for OCON. I just looked at my schedule in OCON. I'm going to be unbelievably busy. Hopefully a lot of you are coming. I think we're going to have a surprise announcement, something exciting that's going to happen in OCON. I'm not going to say a word, I promised. Later this week, you'll probably hear about it, but you're going to have even more reason to come to OCON. It's never too late to register for OCON. So Danielle says, come to Brazil. Yeah, I'm coming to Brazil. I'll be there in late August, early September. It's never too late to register for OCON. It's never too late to buy a cheap ticket on Southwest or an expensive ticket or whatever your fancy is and come to OCON. It's going to be a great event, and there's going to be some fireworks you'll hear about in the next few days, some exciting stuff. Let's see. But OCON generally is exciting. I mean, everything there is really good. Stefan on YouTube is asking me, what did you think of the movie There Will Be Blood? I did not see the movie. I don't know. The descriptions of it struck me as very anti-capitalist, very bloody. I mean, just the title, There Will Be Blood, about business, not the right title for a movie supposedly about business. So I never saw it because I probably should see it. And I think it's with Daniel Day-Lewis, who's a phenomenal actor. So I think I might at some point see it just for that. All right, so I have a number of topics. I am open to your questions on the Super Chat, particularly if they're big questions, topical questions on stuff. I've got a couple of articles that I picked up from Washington Post and from Commentary Magazine that I want to talk about. You know, I might have to talk about what's going on with immigration, or I might wait for a couple of days to talk about it because there's going to be a couple of bills voted on by the House tomorrow. But I don't think any of the bills will pass the Senate, so I'm not sure it's even relevant that they're voting on it in Congress. But yeah, I'll probably say something. I should say something about immigration. But I'm open to topics on the Super Chat, so I'll be waiting for you to be asking questions there. Both the topics, the two topics that I want to talk about, both have to do, again, I'm really kind of digging in on my prep for this talk I'm going to give in Ocon, and I'm building this up, so this talk better be good. But about being a rational optimist in this world, and so both the topics I want to talk about have to do with pessimism and the pessimism that exists out there, both left and right. And the first one is primarily very dominant on the left, and really disgusting and awful. This was an op-ed that was published, I guess, a couple of days ago, on the 18th of June. In the Washington Post, and then there was a commentary on the op-ed, I think today, in Commentary Magazine. And the Washington Post piece is notable for the people who wrote it. These are very prominent people. Francis Kissling, who is the president of the Center for Health, Ethics, and Social Policy. Fact is, I've never really heard of him. Jotham Msingwazi is Director General of Uganda's National Population Council, and the one person who I have heard of and who's important and relevant and very prominent, has been for a long time, is Peter Singer, who is one of the most well-known philosophers in the world today. He's the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University and really the founder of a movement called Effective Altruism. And a huge, huge proponent of altruism. And he takes it seriously. I mean, not really, because he doesn't push the conclusions completely to their logical end. But he is pushing altruism, no disguise. He's interesting and he's challenging to many people. And he's very, very well known, and his ideas are very influential, I think, in academia, because there's a whole center devoted to his ideas at Oxford. But some of the academics, like Rick Salmieri, would have to tell us if he's really that influential in academia. But he's certainly one of the people who is most responsible for kind of popularizing certain views on ethics in the popular culture. So he's definitely a popularizer of ethical discussions, of ethical debates, and he's an ethicist. Anyway, this op-ed is truly shocking, truly shocking. It takes a book, it celebrates, in a sense, a book written 50 years ago, and I guess this was the 50th anniversary to the publication of the book, and this is why they published it. I think that's right. I think the book was written in 68. And the book is The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich. And Ehrlich is a professor of biology at Stanford University and a huge, huge activist within the kind of environmentalist, kind of leftist universe, if you will, in the world out there. So Ehrlich is huge and has been huge, and we'll talk about the population bomb in a minute, but Ehrlich is a significant, very significant intellectual, another one of these people that is cited all the time, quoted all the time. And with Ehrlich, it is particularly disgusting, because 50 years ago, he published this book called The Population Bomb. basically everything he wrote in it turned out to be wrong. He made predictions. He made policy prescriptions. Those policy prescriptions are fairly evil. Can you say that? Can something be fairly evil? No, they're just damn evil. Well, some of them are damn evil. And what these people want to do is they want to resurrect the debate. They want to resurrect the debate that Paul Ehrlich started with the population bomb. It really didn't really start. The population bomb kind of reflected a debate that was going on in the 1960s in the United States and even earlier than the 1960s in the U.S. and broadly in the West and among intellectuals, and really dates back, of course, to the 19th century. And the idea of the book was there are too many people. There are going to be too many people. The population is exploding. We are going to outgrow the planet. We can't feed the people. Indeed, the book predicted, right? And this is a quote: the death rate will increase until at least 100 to 200 million people per year will be starving to death during. And he gave a timeline, so you can't say, well, it'll still happen during the next 10 years. So this would have been in the 1970s. 100 to 200 million people per year would be starving. He said, quote, most of the people who are going to die in the greatest cataclysm in the history of man have already been born. That is, it's going to happen in the lifetime, in people's, that generation's lifetime. You know, it was just, we've reached the limit. We're all going to die. Life expectancy, by the way, of the average American was going to decline by 1980, so 12 years into the future, from 68 to 1990, to 42 years old. So average life expectancy was going to decline in America to 42. So that is what Paul Ehrlich, that's his book. That's his what he predicted. It was an environmentalist, anti-human, anti-reason screed. It was a bestseller. It was prominently and positively reviewed by most of the big newspapers in the United States. He was celebrated as a forward-thinking, one of the intellectual guiding lights of the time. He still is. He's huge behind the whole climate change catastrophe movement. And that's 50 years ago, 1968. Big year, 1968. Of course, his solution to this was ideally family planning. We just need to make sure people have fewer kids. Now, that won't actually prevent the disaster, because the disaster is already going to happen because there are already too many people on the planet. But it will reduce the scope of the disaster and reduce it for decades to come. But of course, if people don't voluntarily engage in family planning, then what the West, when the famines and the natural disasters happen, then, we're going to just have to stop supporting countries. We're just going to have to let them all die. Now, he wasn't doing this out of some sense of self-interest, out of some sense of, it's their problem. It was a sense of, no, this is one way to cull the human population, to get the population under control. Let natural disasters happen. Let people die. Ebola, go at it. Kill as many people as possible. And that way the population will shrink. He came very close, although he didn't quite advocate for this, but he implied that it would be okay to sterilization would be okay. And indeed, this was a period, early, the title of Ehrlich's book is actually lifted, which is called The Population Bomb, is lifted from a 1954 pamphlet that was issued by a general, William Draper, who ran the Population Crisis Committee in the U.S. And that is really the beginning of a big, overpopulation fad in the 20th century. And this really created a situation in which many people were sterilized in the United States. Whether it was one quarter, it is said, of the Native American women of childbearing age were sterilized by 1977. In Puerto Rico, here in Puerto Rico, there was a big campaign to sterilize women of, you know, it focused primarily on American minorities, the sterilization campaigns. But there was definitely this idea that there are too many people, particularly among minorities, they're having too many babies. You know, it was the first thing that came into my head is those babies are going to vote Democratic, so let's make sure we don't have too many of them. But you know, the whole idea of let's have forced population control. Of course, Mao's one child policy came in the 1970s, post this book, as part of this global hysteria about about the population explosion. Thousands, if not more, I've heard it's more like tens or hundreds of thousands of women were sterilized in India by the Indian government. Again, all of the lower classes of the lower castes and forced sterilization. There were payment schemes put in place to pay women to get sterilized. There was a massive campaign around this, and all legitimized by this leading intellectual, leading light of the time, Paul Ehrlich and his predictions. Of course, we all know none of it happened. We all know that the fundamental thing that Paul Ehrlich, all these frigging environmentalists evade, let's put a moral term to it, evade is human reason. It's our ability to innovate, our ability to create, our ability, the fact that, as Julian Simon said, there is no limit to resources. The only limit is human imagination, the human mind, our capacity to reason. And more people is better under circumstances like that, because more people means more people are reasoning, more people are problem solving, more people are thinking, more geniuses are born, and therefore there's more capacity to solve problems. More importantly, why, that's such a negative way to think, there's more capacity to create wealth, to create positive things, to create positive values in the world. So the whole level of population is upside down. I want more people. I mean, ultimately, I want people to make choices about how many children they have individually. But I think having children is a reflection of a certain optimism about the future, a certain confidence about the future. I think it's a good sign when people are having children, not 10 children. Nobody has 10 children. Almost nobody has 10 children voluntarily. They have 10 children either because the religion requires it or because they think five of them are going to die. So, you know, in wealthy, wealthy families that are positive about the future and who like children, I don't want to make a duty out of having children, and who like children and want to have children, you know, you see 2 to 4, 2 to 5 children. That's about it. You don't see more than that. Right. Israelis, by the way, secular Israelis, I mean, more children per capita than any country, any Western country. And I think the reason for that is there's a real sense of excitement and optimism in Israel. There's a real sense of achievement in Israel. There's a real sense that they're doing something significant. There's a meaning to their existence, whether that meaning is rational or not is a question, but even among secular Jews, there really is a sense of purpose. And I'm not talking about a nationalistic purpose, but the economy's doing well, they have good jobs, the country's, they have this thriving high-tech center. People are just energized about life. They seem to enjoy life. They have fun. And I think people like that tend to have kids. And so I just want people to have kids, right? Anyway, so what this new op-ed is saying is the problem is that we can't have a discussion because, you know, after Paul Ehrlich's book came out, some bad things might have been said or might have been done. And by the way, they never in the op-ed say Ehrlich was wrong. Ehrlich was disastrously wrong. They say, as it turns out, Ehrlich's predictions were extreme. Oh my God, extreme? Everything was wrong. I mean, this is like that one article that I read to you a while back about at Marx's birthday about how Marx was all right about everything. It turns out Ehrlich predictions were extreme. No, he was wrong, evasive. And to say this and to not acknowledge the extent to which he was wrong is such an evasion of reality that these ethicists are immoral for doing it. It is just, these are smart people. They know Just read Steven Pinker's Enlightenment Now, and you will see the extent to which Ehrlich and that whole generation of environmentalists, all of those people in the 1960s who were writing about the end of the world, all of them, all for all the variety of different reasons. It's not just that we're wrong. The whole approach was wrong. The reasoning was wrong. Again, the evasion of the achievement of the human mind, all of that was wrong. So they say, oh, well, you know, some of his predictions were a little extreme. But, they say, you know, at the end of the day, you know, and they also say some of his recommendations, like not giving aid when there's famine and natural disasters, yeah, you know, that's probably not right. You know, they don't, well, they didn't really say they don't support that. They kind of stay neutral in that. But then they say, but the real problem is that since then, you know, all these, we haven't had a conversation about overpopulation. And look, while it's true that in Europe, population is shrinking, in Japan, the population is shrinking, there's a real problem in Africa. The population is going out of control. If nothing changes, the population of 26 African countries will at least double by 2050. And by 2100, they're expected to have five times as many people as they do today. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. If nothing changes, but people have made these predictions before and something did change, and the predictions all turned out to be dramatically wrong. And what turned out to be the solution to massive population growth? Why haven't people died? Well, one technology, which they never mention, the entire op-ed goes, never mention technology, never mention the ability to feed basically an infinite number of people, potentially because of the technology we have and the technology we will be inventing. So they never mention technology. But what's the other thing that has made it possible for billions more people to live on Earth successfully? Somebody in YouTube is saying increased productivity. Yeah, wealth creation. But it goes in a number of ways. One, wealth creation provides the wealth that allows you to get the food. And second, wealth creation allows you to live without needing to have 10 kids to work to feed you and to prevent half of them from dying, because they're not dying anymore because of medical science, because wealth has created the medical science that makes it possible, and the wealth has brought that medical science into countries like India where kids are not dying. So why would you assume that populations in Africa, just on a factual basis, why would you assume that populations in Africa are just going to increase without any changes? Why are you assuming that they're not going to become wealthier and therefore they're going to have fewer kids? Why are you assuming that we're not going to have more resources to provide for those kids? Why are they assuming that as those cultures get more technology, become wealthier, and therefore have fewer kids because the kids are not dying? Why do they think that Africans are stupid and going to behave differently than Asians behaved? And why aren't they advocating, and this is true of the commentary article as well, which is, while a good article, again, misses the point completely. If you are concerned about some of these African countries having growing populations and not creating enough wealth to match the population, then why aren't you advocating for policies that increase the amount of wealth that they have? Why aren't you advocating for more economic freedom in Africa so that they become as rich as China and India, so that they can support growing populations? And more than that, so they can support a standard of living and a quality of life that just reduces the number of kids as well, so the population is not growing as much as you are predicting. That's the solution. But no, you see, they can't think that because, oh my God, growing populations, that's more natural resources being used, that's more carbon fuels, that's more climate change, that's more, I don't know, garbage, and we don't have any way to put the garbage, and what's going to happen with the garbage. Economic growth is a problem. Human prosperity is a problem. Human success is a problem. Human flourishing is a problem. It's not that they're worried about overpopulation and starvation. No, they just are worried about, they're worried about human success. They're worried about human progress. They're worried about economic growth. In every aspect, part of economic growth comes from economic, from the fact that there's more people doing more work. They're not even, you know, they're not even making the robots argument. Where are these people going to get jobs? You know, at least they're not making that. You know, then of course they bring in climate change. Prospects of African prosperity also threatened by climate change. As if prosperity has anything to do with weather. As if prosperity has anything to do with weather. But that's how they think. That's how they think. It's disgusting. Now, this reminds me of a movie I just saw, Black Panther. And I, you know, there's a lot to say about Black Panther, the movie. There's a lot of things I dislike about the movie. Basically, I dislike the whole superhero genre, and it fits right in there. I found it boring and uninteresting and stupid and contrived and all the rest of it. So I didn't enjoy it even as just a superhero movie. But one of the things I found amusing about it, amusing, kind of, not really. I mean, there's a whole racial thing and a whole racist aspect to it, which we can talk about, you know, the whole Wakanda, let's help all the blacks in the world aspect to it, which altruistic and also just terrible. I thought Wonder Woman, you know, sorry, Anne Schell, but I don't know what was so great about Wonder Woman other than she was pretty, which is important, I guess, but still. What I found offensive about Black Panther is the basic assumption made in the movie, and not just made, explicitly stated, that wealth comes from natural resources. Wealth comes from natural resources, right? Because they have this thing, it's some blue material, I can't remember its name, but this blue stuff. And because they happen to have the tribe on the blue stuff, because of that, that's why they're so rich, technologically advanced, super duper crazy successful. It's because they have the blue stuff, right? Now, I don't know how that works. Like, lots of tribes had gold and they vibranium. That's right, vibranium. Vibranium is just, ooh, wonder material. And it came from like the stars, right? From an asteroid. But what the hell? Lots of tribes had gold that didn't make them wealthy or certainly didn't make them technologically advanced. Lots of people have lived on oil reserves, didn't make them wealthy, except in modern times, and it certainly didn't make them technologically advanced. But somehow, it is the natural resource that makes Wakanda, Wabamba, or something, right? Wakanda, a prosperous, successful, fantastic, wonderful, peaceful, amazing, technologically 100 years into the future place. Not human reason. Not science and technology, not philosophy, not ideas, God forbid. No, it's natural resources. And this same thing here, right? Climate change. Climate is what makes you prosperous. I guess if you're cold, you work harder, and therefore you produce more wealth. If you're hot, you don't work hard, and therefore, you know, you stay poor, I guess. There goes Italy. There goes Spain. There goes Israel. There goes a lot of places that are fairly warm and are pretty wealthy on global standards. There goes Texas. Oh, my God. There goes Texas. Whew. Austin, finished. So the authors are basically saying Africa's in trouble because the population bomb is right, and we need to control population in Africa, and we need to do it in clever ways, and we need to encourage them to have safe sex and do all this. And it partially, it's just so disgusting. So disgusting. Because, I mean, it smacks of racism. Here are these rich white guys going to tell black Africa how many kids to have, and they're gonna send them, you know, population control mechanisms and maybe even coerce them if, these intellectuals in the West don't think that they're having the right number of kids. But they're certainly going to provide them with education and sex education, because, you know, what do they know about sex? It's just so despicable, and you know, this whole attitude. Not sure. Contraception is great. Sex education is great. I have nothing against any of these things. Family planning is good. Protecting women's rights in Africa is important. You know, too many women are abused there and don't realize they have control over their own life and should have control over their own bodies. Abortion rights should be respected in Africa. But to tell them how many kids they should have, to, you know, what we should do is free Africa up. And as I said, the more people, the better. The more people, the better. And that's true in Africa. That's true in Asia. That's true in Europe. The only place where I'd rather not see more people because they're so brainwashed by a particular form of ideas is the Muslim world. But again, the solution is not to have less kids, but to reform the Muslim world. It's to enlighten the Muslim world and then have as many kids as you want. There's nothing in their genes that says that they are inferior people, therefore there should be fewer of them. So, yeah, Population Bomb, 50 years ago published, one of the most evil books published in the late 20th century, certainly out of an American academic. And what is particularly disgusting is that Paul Ehrlich, the author of The Population Bomb, is still a prominent intellectual. So anytime you hear anything that Paul Ehrlich says, turn it off. It's just garbage. And speak up against it. Speak up against it. Against this idea that a group of central planning intellectuals are going to dictate to people how many kids they shouldn't have. And that's true on the flip side as well. That's true. I'm against programs in Poland and where the government is trying to encourage people to have more babies. Butt out. Stay out of my life. Freedom. For those of you who think Poland is this wonderful, liberated, modern place that we should all try to emulate. No, none of your business, none of the government's business, none of anybody's business. How many kids you have, Poles or any other type, any other group. All right, on the topic of Africa, how would you respond to people who refer to Somalia as capitalist? I guess I would laugh my head off. To be serious, I would say they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know Somalia, and they don't know what capitalism is. Somalia is much more closer to feudalism, to ancient tribalism, to little clans controlling different territories and running their economies there based on mafia principles of the people with the guns dictating what will happen. Now, I will say this. Somalia is what so-called anarcho-capitalism looks like. That is, Somalia is, quote, anarcho-capitalism. But let me say something very clearly. There is no such thing as anarcho-capitalism. There is capitalism, and there is anarchy. And anarchy is the opposite of capitalism. And Somalia is much more like anarchy. It's the rule of the gun. It's the rule of force. It's a dangerous, horrible, primitive, poor, pathetic country. And actually, there's a country to the north of it. Addis Ababa is the capital. This is Ethiopia, which I think is economically far more successful, and it's far from anarchy. So the idea that if you're poor and there's nothing around, anarchy is better than alternative. It's just nonsense. It's just garbage. And unfortunately, the garbage is coming out of places like George Mason. But it's Austrian economist and George Mason. But no, Somalia is not capitalist. Capitalism is a system of individual rights. It's a system in which government protects individual rights. It's a system in which all property is privately owned. There is no private property in Somalia. There is no government in Somalia. There is no protection of individual rights in Somalia. The clans don't protect individual rights. I saw a presentation by David Friedman. This is Milton Friedman's son. And I wanted to pull all my hair out. I still got hair. I wanted to pull it up. He was giving examples of private law, the private law of clansmen in Somalia, barbaric law, law that basically views a woman as the property of her husband, law that is basically It is unobjective, completely non-objective, based on religion and tradition. This is capitalism? This is in Somalia. Yeah, but libertarians have latched onto Somalia because there's no government in Somalia. It's part of why Somalia is one of the worst places to live on planet Earth. Because there's no government. Because even a bad government, it turns out, I'll say something controversial here, even a bad government is better than no government. No government is absolutely a disaster. A disaster. Please, I mean, I really hope some of these people go live in Somalia. I guess they'll deserve what they get. But no, there's nothing, not a little bit, nothing that relates Somalia to capitalism. Somalia is the opposite of capitalism. All right, we've got two other Super Chat questions. What do you say to people that say immigrants drive down wages due to taking jobs for a lesser price? Yeah, I think that happens. That's the law of supply and demand, right? So some jobs, immigrants are willing to do cheaper. It drives down wages in some jobs. So what? You have a right to the wage that you've always received. If you can't keep up, if somebody else will come in and compete against you, why is that a bad thing? Why is it suddenly a bad thing that that people are competing wages down? I think it's a good thing. It means good product, the cost of goods is going to be driven down. That is, the amount of money people spend on consumption is going to go down, which means the amount of money people have to invest goes up, which means more economic activity is going to be generated, which means more jobs are going to be created. So those people who lost their jobs, they want their jobs, to immigrants will then have other jobs elsewhere that they can pick up. And generally, when you have competition for labor and when labor prices are driven downwards, what you get is a rising standard of living. Let me say it again. What you get is a rising standard of living. So while it is true that immigrants drive down wages in some sectors, they overall raise the standard of living of the population. So it's good to have labor competition. It's good to have competition on television. It's good to have competition for computers. It's good to have competition for everything. So why would it be bad to have competition for jobs? It's good. And, you know, it's not just – and the fact is that you're not just competing with immigrants. You're competing with laborers in China. You're competing with laborers in Germany who are very productive. You're competing with laborers in Ukraine who are very smart and have a very low cost of living, so they can program a lot cheaper than American programmers could do. You're competing with robots. So shake it up, people. Wake up, because your jobs are not guaranteed. Nobody's going to guarantee a job for you. You're going to have to go out there and hustle. You're going to have to find a job. You're going to have to work hard. You're going to have to prove yourself. Because if you're not good enough, you're going to be fired. And if it's not fired because of an immigrant taking your job, it's going to be fired because another American is taking your job, a Chinese person is taking your job, or a Ukrainian person is taking your job, or a robot is taking your job. And all of that is good. Right? And you should have that perspective. You should have that perspective that if you are doing something that can be replaced by somebody else, then you better hustle. And living in a world in which you can hustle, living in a world in which, because other people are hustling, the standard of living is going up and values are being created that are making your life a better life, that is incredibly valuable, more valuable than any particular job. So it's in your interest that people compete with you for the job that you have. It's in your interest to live in a system in which you can lose a job to an immigrant who will do the job for less money than you will. That's a good thing, even if it causes you short-term pain. Nobody has a right to be free of competition. Nobody has a right to stagnate. So there's a fabulous, one of the best essays, Something Right to Stagnate. Somebody will let you know, and let me know in the chat. The right to stagnate. And it's exactly about this. It's about people saying, oh, we can't allow competition. We can't allow progress. We can't allow anything more. You know, God forbid, it scares the status quo. And the status quo is it. We don't want progress. We want to stagnate. We will fight to stagnate. Thank you, Ryan. The Divine Right of Stagnation, a fantastic essay by Ayn Rand. And that's exactly what's being expressed here. So I embrace the fact that immigrants lower wages. Good. Good. If I can pay my gardener less, then why not? And if I can buy my car for less, then why not? I have more money to do more stuff elsewhere in the economy. So from a moral perspective, who are you? Who is anybody to tell me how much I should pay my gardener? Who is anybody to tell me who I should be employing? And from an economics perspective, such restrictions and such barriers to competition are completely absurd, and no economist worth anything would support them. And that's one other way in which I'm pro-immigration. I want competition for labor. All right. My camera's unstable. Wiggly. We're going to get a better camera, better setup, more stable, better picture quality, so you guys who are on YouTube are better entertained. We're this close to 6,000. That's where all this happens, right? So I think we're like $200 away. So if you be tempted, as you should have been, to support me on Patreon, now's a great time. Just let's get me over that hump in June. Over the 6,000, we're going to get a much nicer space here. We're going to get a better camera. We're going to do some stuff to soften up the walls so the sound quality is a little better. I don't think sound is primarily the thing people are complaining about. And we're going to do a lot of great interviews. I think some of you enjoyed the God Sod interview, the Rajshree Agrawal. You should really watch the Rajshree Agrawal interview. It's really good. And we're going to be doing, you know, almost an interview a week when I have time. So we're going to be tons of interviews. There's a lot that's going to be happening in the next few weeks, months. And as I said, we're going to be taking, we're going to be doing some stuff from OCON. There's going to be a lot of fun stuff happening. Okay, one more super chat question. Be noticing frequent news articles on horrible staffing problems with the NHS. Wow, I'm shocked. I assume this is something you predicted. Or is this from Brexit? No, it's a combination, right? And I would have predicted it being a consequence of Brexit. It's a consequence of the NHS, of a government-run organization that can't pay people enough, that rations care, that can't afford to run world-class facilities, but it can't afford to hire staff. But it's also a reflection of the anti-immigration attitude that exists in England, particularly as a consequence of Brexit. Do you know that there are almost no English-born dentists in England? Because given how much the NHS pays dentists to treat patients, it's free, part of the NHS, then no English person is going to go study dentistry. So all the dentists are imported, primarily from Pakistan and India. So most of the dentists in England come from overseas. You're just not going to get British dentists. They can't. It just doesn't pay well enough. But if you're coming from Pakistan, the pay is not bad. And you don't have many options, and it's cheaper to study dentistry in Pakistan, and it's not a bad system. It's based education. Some of the educational system in Pakistan is based on the British system from when England colonized that area. So they have a fairly good, medical schools and dentistry schools and so on. So if you start restricting immigration, or if you start making it just unattractive for people to come in, then this is one of the consequences. You're going to have a problem in staffing. Nurses, there's a massive global shortage of nurses. And the only way to solve that problem is to free up kind of immigration controls. Because if the bigger the barriers, the harder it is for somebody to enter the United States, let's say, with a nursing degree, the less people are going to go to nursing school, let's say in the Philippines or Indonesia, because they don't anticipate that they're going to be able to emigrate to the United States once they get the degree. If they knew that they would have a job when they graduated in the U.S. because there's such a huge nursing shortage, they would go and get that degree. So it's our immigration policies. It's the U.S. and it's the West's immigration policies. And, it's tragic. And the immigration bills going through Congress right now are not going to solve that problem. They're just making it worse. They are just making it worse. Tom Ramsey in England says, my last two dentists are from Eastern Europe. Okay, so maybe in more modern times, I'd say probably the last 10, 15 years, you've gotten more dentists from Eastern Europe coming over since the war came down, and fewer from Pakistan. But 10, 15 years ago, every dentist, almost every dentist in England was Pakistani. So, immigration. If we had a rational immigration policy in the U.S., in other words, an immigration policy that at the very least said, if you have a job in the U.S., you can come in, then, they would come in. Then they would go to they would go to school in their local countries, and then they would come in. So George says Islam is the problem in Somalia and not anarchy. That's bullshit, right? So Islam is a problem everywhere Islam exists, but that's not the problem in Somalia. The problem in Somalia is anarchy. Anarchy there is a consequence of Islam because there is a battle going on between more secular forces in Somalia and in Somalia who are fighting against the Islamists, and there's a constant conflict between the Islamists and the less, the ones who don't want to live under Sharia law, and there's a constant conflict and a constant war there. But there are lots of Islamic countries who are Muslim who are better off than Somalia. Not good, but better off than Somalia. And so just because you have a predominantly Muslim population doesn't mean you're going to be as bad of a state as Somalia is in. So Somalia, because it doesn't have a government, can't actually rein in the Islamist crazy nutty forces. Egypt is in much better state than Somalia. Not that Egypt's in good state. It's a corrupt third world country. But I'd much rather live in Egypt than in Somalia, as would almost every person on the planet. The problem is anarchy. I don't care what the people believe. Anarchy turns into violence. Anarchy in Iceland in ancient times was a disaster. It was a disaster everywhere you have anarchy. Feudalism basically is anarchy. Feudal pre-statehood Europe was basically anarchy, and it was a disaster. Horrible wars, tribalism, hunter-gatherers, all of that is anarchy, and all of that is not good for human development. It's not a fertile environment for human progress. I don't know what Texit is. What's Texit? I have no idea what that means. Texas leaving? I don't know. George says, including the U.S. government, Texit. Oh, you want Texas to exit the U.S. All right. What then? First of all, it's not going to happen. The United States will never let Texas leave, and Texas is not going to vote to leave. But then what do you do? You build walls around Texas? Really? Do you have tariffs? Does Texas have tariffs with the U.S.? Do they have a common trading area like the EU? Does Texas ban abortions? Is that a good thing? No, it's an awful thing. So how much of Texas becomes a little bit theocratic once they don't have a Bill of Rights and they're not linked in any way to the Constitution? I love Texas. I lived in Texas. I'm a huge Texas fan. But I don't know. I think the Constitution still anchors even Texas against its worst elements. And I think there's some really bad elements in Texas. I'm for Puerto Rico exit, which, but down the road, not yet. After we turn Puerto Rico into the Hong Kong of the Caribbean, then I'm for Puerto Rico exit. That's my next thing. Okay, we're almost out of time. That flew by really, really fast. And I only covered one of the topics I wanted to... banning abortion is evil. So, George, sorry, we're not on the same side. But the banning abortion is evil. And I would not want to live in a country that banned abortions. I think it's despicable. Banning abortion is a complete disrespect for human life. What's your thought on Peter Schiff? He lives in Puerto Rico too. Maybe you guys can hang out and do shows. We will at some point. We haven't met up in Puerto Rico. We're friendly. Haven't met up in Puerto Rico. We've both been incredibly busy, but we will. We will at some point. We will. Peter Schiff's a good guy. I don't agree with him on everything, but he's certainly a good guy, and it would be fun to hang out with him and maybe do some podcasts together. That would be cool. I'm not gonna get a thing of slinging things, but no, banning abortion is evil, and the unborn clearly have no rights because they're not born, they're not human beings, and there is no right to a clump of cells in the first month. A human being is not created at conception. It's just a potentiality to come from cells early on. So no, there is the pro-life position is a pro-abortion position. If you're pro-life, if you're pro-individual rights, if you're pro the right to life, you have to be pro-abortion. All right. Yeah, I want to tackle this one other article in the commentary, which is actually really good. It was written by James. As much as you guys want to suck me into an abortion debate, I don't really want to. It's written by an economist from the American Enterprise Institute. It's very good. And it basically makes the point that one of the things that's going on in America today is that the left and right seem to be equally pessimistic about the U.S. economy in the last 40 years. So there's a perception both on the left and on the Trump right that the middle class has been screwed over the last 40 years in America. That over the last 40 years, the middle class's earnings have not grown at all. That there has been basically complete stagnation. That while the rich have gotten richer, the middle class has gone nowhere and done nothing and just been flat. And this is why the middle class is so angry, particularly white working class adults. They're frustrated because their life since the mid-1970s has not gotten better. And what is truly stunning about this story, is that both left and the Trumpites share it. They both think that this story is true. And I think much of Trump's appeal is that he was kind of on the right telling the story, telling the Bernie Sanders story. This is Bernie Sanders' story. This is Paul Krugman's story. This is George Stiglitz's story. This is the story of the people who write all the articles about the horrible inequality is going up. Now, I dealt with this quite extensively with Don Watkins in Inequal is Unfair, a book, which is really to a large extent about this topic. And we go over this history and show that just the math is wrong. Everything they say about the history of the last 40 years is just wrong. That the middle class has done brilliantly in the United States. Indeed, one of the problems is, and there was the study that was done, if you take the United States and you break it out into 20% ranges, so the bottom 20%, the top 20%, and then the three 20% groups in the middle, so you have poor, rich, lower middle class, upper middle class, and middle class. So you break it up that way. What you see is that, and you look over the last 40 years at those four groups, what you see is that the group that was middle class has shrunk. So there are fewer people in that middle class grouping, that middle 20% of incomes. That has shrunk. But that's primarily because, the group of upper middle class has exploded. The biggest growth in any income group has been in the upper middle class. So Americans have gotten richer, significantly richer. The middle class has gotten richer, significantly richer over the last 40 years. Reagan's policies, deregulation, technology, robots, computers, the increase in productivity as a consequence of all this have dramatically driven up the standard of living of Americans. The idea that both Trump and Bernie Sanders tried to sell us on, that life in 1975 was just the same as life is this today for most Americans, is complete bullshit and completely evasive, completely, utterly devout from the facts of reality. This is the question I ask anybody. Would you rather have, in today's dollars, $50,000 today or $100,000 in 1975? So in 1975, $100,000 or $50,000 today? What would you rather have? I'd much rather have $50,000 today. Because in 1975, no matter how rich I was, I couldn't buy an iPhone. In 1975, no matter how rich I was, I couldn't get on the internet. in 1975, no matter how rich I was, I couldn't have a flat screen television and access to Netflix. $50,000 today, can have all of that. Doesn't cost that much. None of those things cost that much. Think about what your dollar actually buys. Our inflation numbers do not reflect the massive advancements in productivity, in quality of life, in the kind of goods that you have today. And I would argue CPI has generally been overstated over the last 40 years. Say actual, even in the measurement of inflation, the way they measure price inflation, the rise in prices, has been, they've overestimated. You can have 1975. I ain't taking 1975. Robert wants 1975. I wouldn't take the 1950s. I wouldn't take any era. I'd much rather have a small amount of money today than much more money in the past. I mean, your likelihood today of dying of cancer is far lower. Let's say if you're my age today or my age in 1975, you're much more likely. We probably added you easily 2-3 years to life expectancy, but probably more than that for anybody my age looking forward. We probably added 5-6 years. I mean, wow, that's a lot of time. A lot of time. We know so much more today. We know so much more today than we did in 1975. So I would absolutely take today over 1975. Well, yeah, if you knew the future and you could go backwards. Cars had no HP. I don't even know what HP is. What's HP? I don't know what HP is. Maybe somebody will tell me what HP is and I can comment on that. Yeah, everybody's going back and betting on the future that they now know. Horsepower. That's right. Think about what you can get today. You can get a Mercedes-Benz AMG C63 with something like 600 horsepower. I mean, you couldn't get a car like that in the 1970s. Oh my God. So somebody's asking, I don't see their name. They're putting up 500 yen. Is that yen? I don't know what that is. They're saying Rand said Aristotle is the only philosopher to consider. Why is this not irrational? In my opinion, each idea should be contended with and dismissed after evaluation. I don't think she ever said that. What she said was that Aristotle, something like, and I'm paraphrasing, that Aristotle was the only philosopher who, you know, contributed in a substantial way to philosophical knowledge, and particularly to the kind of philosophy that's pro-man, pro-human flourishing. The only philosopher she really learned something from. But she considered lots of philosophers, and she knocked them down. She evaluated them all. I mean, she didn't study them in depth, and I don't think everybody needs to study rotten ideas. But a philosopher should. So if you're a philosopher, if your job is ideas, then you have to, yes, consider all kinds of ideas and dismiss them. But you don't have to consider all ideas. I mean, that you would never end. You consider the ideas that have a dominant impact on the culture, and you decide if they're true or false. You consider dominant ideas maybe in academia. You know, the dominant ideas that are influential. You can't consider every idea. And a lot of ideas are bad ideas, and they need to be dismissed quickly. The question is, what is your goal? Your goal is to live a better life, then look at the best ideas. You don't have to go through all the ideas. Okay, Anshul still wants me to do a John Oliver Iran show. I still haven't figured out how to do it. When I do, you will know. All right, so I'd recommend this article. It's called The Great American Melt Up. And I would say one of the things that dominates the political conversation today, both on the left and the right, and one of the great American tragedies, in my view, is that both left and right have a very negative view of economic progress over the last 40 years in America. Both have a dark view of the American middle class. Both have a dark view of the role of technology. And that's Trump and Sanders, the Trump and Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party share their contempt, really, for what has happened in America in the last 40 years. And while I am very critical of a lot of what's happened, to deny the economic success, to deny the progress, to deny the dramatic increase in standard of living, to deny the increased quality of life that we have is just out and out wrong. Somebody's asking about, what about Abelard, Aquinas, Grotius? She talked about Aquinas. Abelard wasn't as significant as Aquinas, so she dealt with Aquinas. Yeah, I mean, if you're in the business of ideas, you should know something about Abelard. You should know something about Aquinas. You should know something about Grotius and Pufendorf, who both kind of started the discussion really on individual rights that led to Locke. You should know Locke. I don't know Reed. You should know Spooner. You should be critical of Spooner, Lusky, Lane, Peterson, Patterson. Yeah, I mean, depending on the influence, they should all be dealt with. And she did. And she did. And did they all have an influence on her? I don't know. You don't know that. You claim that, but how do you know that? I don't know that Spooner had an influence on Ayn Rand. Lusky had an influence on, I don't even know who Lusky is. Locke, yeah, I mean, she respected some of what Locke said and was very, very critical of the rest of what Locke said. But fundamentally, she said that the only person who had a profound impact on her philosophy was Aristotle. You could say she doesn't know what she's talking about herself, but that's what she said. So you can say she wasn't very attuned to herself, but I doubt that's true. Cicero, Seneca, I don't know if they had an impact on Ayn Rand. I don't know if she read Cicero and Seneca. You know, I don't see what the point is. If you think that these are important people, if you think that these are important people to study, then study them. Nobody's saying don't study them. Lasky was a professor in Russia. Yes, there's a theory out there that he had a big impact on it, but there are other people who claim he didn't. So I don't know. Why is that so important to you? I mean, again, if you want to live a good life, I think read Ayn Rand, study Aristotle, and then study philosophy to the extent that it interests you and to the extent that it contributes to a good life. You don't have to read everybody and refute everybody. What you should seek is the truth. If you're an intellectual, if you're a professional intellectual, or if you're interested in philosophy, then read widely, figure out who said what, figure out what's truth and what's not true, and work with that and delve deep into some stuff. And you know, there's no end to the number of thinkers and philosophers out there that you could study and you know, follow your interests. Nobody says don't study them. Nobody said don't look at them. It's important. The influences on her are important in terms of Rand scholarship, but I think the most important Rand scholarship scholars that I know don't buy some of these claims about people who influenced her that you argue. But you know, I'm not a Rand scholar in that sense. I'm not interested particularly in who influenced Ayn Rand. The only thing that interests me is the extent to which her philosophy is true or not true, the areas that I understand in her philosophy, the areas I don't, the things that I need to study and improve my understanding in, and how to apply the philosophy, which I think is damn hard, and there's plenty of work to do there. I do not widely read in other philosophers because I'm not that interested at this point, and it doesn't contribute to what I want to do and what I need to do. I study on a case-by-case basis as needed, but you know, I'm not a philosopher and I'm not a scholar trying to understand how Ayn Rand's ideas evolved. If you are, all the power to you. Go study that, but you know, be wary of taking some scholars' views as untouchable. You know, study it firsthand and figure out what's true and what's not. All right, I think we're done, unless somebody jumps up with a big dollar amount for a question. I think we're at about an hour, which is the right length for these shows. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel. Keep subscribing if you're interested in studying objectivism, if you're interested in what Ayn Rand actually thought. Read Oppa, read Ayn Rand, read The Virtue of Selfishness and Capitalism, an ideal philosophy, who needs it? And then there's a bunch of other, The Voice of Reason. Just read Ayn Rand. Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, if you're interested in epistemology. Read Ayn Rand. I can't say it enough, but so few people I know who claim to be objectivist and who claim to be interested in Ayn Rand's ideas, read Ayn Rand. Read her nonfiction. Read her nonfiction. Go out there and read. A lot of it's available for free at AynRand.org/campus. And then if you're interested in studying the ideas further and deeper, then take Leonard Peikoff's courses. Read OPA and take Leonard Peikoff's courses. And if you're a scholar of Ayn Rand's ideas, then go get the book, The Companion of Ayn Rand, on Ayn Rand, and that Greg Salimieri and Alan Gotthelf edited. And you can get that on Kindle at a reasonable price. I think the hardback copy is unreasonably priced. But you can get it on Kindle. So go out there. There's so much content today. Oh, my God. When I started studying objectivism, it was so hard to get anything. It was so hard to get a nonfiction book by Ayn Rand. There was no secondary literature. There was nothing by Leonard Peikoff. There were no courses. There were no podcasts. There were no videos. There was no Ayn Rand no listening to Ayn Rand. It was just so difficult. Today, there's this massive amount of content out there. And some of you, at least, it's tragic, are not taking advantage of it. Instead of watching another Jordan Peterson video, go listen to Leonard Peikoff. It'll rock your world. It'll rock your world. Go read an Ayn Rand nonfiction book. It'll blow your mind how deep she was and how interesting she was and how fresh her perspective was and how different it was even from what you would expect it to be as an objectivist. All right. Thanks, everybody. It was great. And there are lots of videos of Rand herself. You should go watch those. But again, I think the most important thing is to read Ayn Rand's nonfiction and to take Leonard Peikoff's courses and to read. Just read. There's a ton. Okay. Subscribe, Facebook, Twitter. You know the drill. And of course, don't forget, please, to support me on Patreon. Let's get in the next couple of days. Let's destroy the suspense and get over the 6,000 mark so we can get on with life. And those of you who are going to be at OCON, I will see you in OCON. We're going to have more shows. I definitely have a show on Saturday and Sunday. I can't remember if I have a show tomorrow or not. Might have a show tomorrow. Next week and the week after that are going to be spotty because of OCON. And then, the summer is going to be pretty full of shows. So I'm excited. Hopefully you are too. If you have topics you want me to talk about, and you become a Patreon contributor, then that is the good place to express your views about the topics. And of course, you can always use the super chat to ask me a question. Would you do a JRE episode? What's JRE? JRE? I don't know. I want to see myself and Joe Rogan, so I'm waiting for the call. Waiting for the call. And somebody suggested I try to interview Steven Pinker. I might try to interview Steven Pinker. But Joe Rogan Experience. I would do Joe Rogan in an instant. I'd fly over to do it, but he hasn't called me. He hasn't invited me yet. I'm still waiting for him to invite me. So if you guys have any influence with Joe Rogan, please ask him to invite me. Yep. All right. Thanks, everybody. I appreciate the support. I appreciate your time. And I will talk to you all very soon. Bye.